species, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
It's Monday, the 3rd of January, 2012. My name's Martin Paul, and I'm joined here today by Peter. We're the brothers that put out the Information Podcast. And today we are going to discuss 2012 and all the mystery, all the prophecy surrounding this mythical year. And we're going to establish our views on this, and we're going to try and encapsulate all the multiple theories on what this year represents, whether it's a damp squiz or whether it's some great year of profound implications for humankind. So from the outset, I guess it's probably a good idea to establish the fact that the fireworks have now ceased. We are here in the third day of the year, kind of at that time when New Year's Day is past, the hangovers have ceased. We're all kind of starting to get back into the vibe of going to work, doing the 9-to-5. And already you start to get a sense of there being just the norm out there, nothing new. Would you say that, Peter?
I don't know, Martin. Well, hi, welcome to the recording and talk, and pleased to be here. I did, as you know, put out a sort of semi-live broadcast on the night at the turn of 2012, and I was mulling over these various topics, and as I said at the time, you know, these fireworks have got bigger and bigger every year since the millennium, and it used to be you just jump into the Trafalgar Square, you know, and jump into the fountain sort of thing, and it seems to be a kind of hyping up of New Year every year into a massive thing. And I didn't see though any of the 2012 more philosophical views of life reflected in the mainstream coverage.
No.
Didn't watch all of it, but it was very much the usual whoopee merchant saying, yeah, it's 2012. And then we had the London parade yesterday on Sunday, which was the 1st of January. It gets very confusing because it's a bank holiday Monday today. So although you're right to talk about 9-to-5, of course, really that starts tomorrow.
It does, yeah.
But it was a kind of Lord Mayor's parade yesterday in London. They had the Olympic characters. They had a strange teddy bear that looked rather sinister with, I don't know, it looked quite scary, its eyes. It looked like, I wouldn't want it coming near me if I was a kid. I have to say, it wasn't as bad as Wenlock and whatever those one-eyed New World Order characters they've got. But they had these characters putting the rings together in the middle of the road and trying to make it out, yeah, the Olympics are here, you know, kind of forced party spirit, which... you know, there was a small crowd watching, but I did get the feeling that it was all a bit kind of planned, and here we go, we've got to have this moment and get Seb Coe out saying it's Olympics happening.
Yeah. You know,
at the same time, they're talking about, you know, possible fixing of the games, and already talking about, you know, cons going on, and it'd be a betting syndicate making money out of it and this sort of thing.
Yeah, and it, certainly in the UK, you get this sense that the media are really... treating this year as the year of the Olympics, and there's nothing more to this year than that. I mean, that seems to be the impression you get in the UK, and obviously, I mean, around the world, that's going to vary. But I'm keen to identify changes and to sort of look for things that sort of signify, that, you know, potential 2012-esque style events that we've all been waiting for 20, 30 years now.
Mm.
And it's difficult because I remain open-minded about all this stuff, and I try to have an impartial view on things. Mm. But a part of me, like with everyone else, I'm sure, wants there to be some change now in society.
Mm.
And whether that's some sort of spiritual change, whether it's just some political change, there's a craving out there for it. And I think that's part of what this whole St. Paul's Occupy movement's all about, all around the world. St. Paul's in the UK, which is where they've based themselves. But... it's always difficult because this is just the first few days of the year. And I mean, the thing that I'm keeping my eye on at the moment is this Iran situation.
Yeah.
Because I just feel that there could be a real event here brewing, like it could act as a catalyst for some kind of conflict that perhaps might be designed as the great distraction to put people off the obviously the economic situation, which is still dire with the EU, and you know, obviously the euro. There's talk of the euro plunging and perhaps even failing at some point.
Yeah, sure.
So it's difficult, but you look to people like David Icke.
Yeah.
And David Icke now sort of suggests in his newsletter that 2012 is just going to be the start of a process that may take years or perhaps even decades to unfold. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I mean, David Icke, I've got a lot of respect for David Icke, and I've read, well, I'd say probably half of the books he's put out. He's he's obviously put out a ton of books. But 10, 15 years ago, I think he perhaps had more of a traditional 2012 view. I remember reading in his books in the 90s that he believed that really we would see great changes this year.
Yeah.
But David Icke, like everybody, he's evolved over the last 10 years, and I think his views are now based more in harsh reality and in the way things unfold. And I think he understands now that perhaps 2012 is just the beginning of some change as opposed to some great end-of-world-style scenario. So obviously the Mayan calendar is where most people come from when they look at 2012. Yeah. They look at this December 2012 prediction, which obviously we're not near yet, but I'm less inclined to sort of go down that route now. I mean, I still think there's significance in the Mayan prophecies, but I think it's dangerous to rely on it and to hope for this great event, because I think it was, I can't remember the guy's name, but there was a character we attended one of their lectures about a year ago in Brighton, a really good speaker, who argued that one of the things that he was scared of now was the fact that a lot of people are actually relying on 2012 to represent a great catalyst for change.
So was that Ian R. Crane?
Ian R. Crane, yeah. That's the guy.
Yeah, we
fantastic
that
speaker,
we put
yeah.
That on information,
we
yeah.
did. But he mentioned that it was possibly during his lecture, it may have been as part of an after the presentation sort of conversation we had off mic with him. He mentioned that he was right that people would actually just end up committing suicide in large waves because of the fact that they relied so heavily on this idea of 2012 that if we enter into 2013 and there's no great significant change, people would suddenly be completely disillusioned by the New Age movement and all this talk of spirituality and all this business.
Sure.
And that's one of the concerns that I have. It's the concern that you're going to see a lot of people out there, certainly on the internet, on various forums, basically losing hope and starting to kind of reject all of this stuff because of the fact that they feel that 2012 has been a bit of a you know, as I say earlier, a damp squid.
Yeah. Well, what are they expecting to see though, Martin? I mean, David Icke was looking ahead from the 90s, so it's like the old cliche, the grass is always greener on the other side of the hill. Yeah, you're looking into the distance, you're seeing what looks good ahead of you. And it will look great, a landscape will look wonderful from a distance. And I'm someone who walks a lot in the countryside, and I found it's given me a lot of wisdom over the years of spiritual understanding from a very rooted tradition of being involved with something real. And you can transpose that to this sort of subject. You could say that if time is represented by a landscape, you know, looking ahead to the horizon, or if a hill that's a long way away, but it's caught in the sunlight looking wonderful, that might represent 2012, and it looks fantastic, and it is fantastic, but you get to it, it's going to be nettles, there's going to be, you know, rocks you've got to climb over, it may be muddy, you know, it's going to be flowers and wildlife there, but it's a real place, it's not some little nirvana that's done in a storybook with watercolours, with fairies and flying through it, and you know, like in a kiddie's illustration, it's a real thing, and you know, there is an awakening. You have awakenings within difficult situations. Spiritual awareness of being, living in the moment, having instinct, and not needing to download lots of stuff off the internet, or needing to ask questions because you know the answer already. As a friend of ours from many years ago, Glyn Cork, used to say, he was a very spiritual guy, very ahead of his time, and used to run a shop called The Sales Zone, and I interviewed him back in 1997, and we put it out on the information if you scroll back through the various episodes. Glyn would say at one point, he quoted something from a film which I still haven't seen, called 7 Years in Tibet, you know, it was talking about if you had a problem that you knew the answer to, you didn't have a problem. If you didn't know the answer, there's no point getting stressed about it.
Mm.
And you live in the moment, live in the now. Is that Eckhart Tolle, I think, wrote a book with The Power of Now. It's very much about this sort of subject. But, I mean, what are they... If I say there's an awakening, I'm not quite sure. I mean, Gandalf isn't going to appear in the corner and you know, tap you on the head.
Sure. Or
Ben Kenobi isn't going to come in and you know, give you a lightsaber. It'd be great if he did. It's more likely to be inside you. And all those stories were symbolic anyway of this type of subject. I mean, Tolkien went back to ancient myths and George Lucas's mind Tolkien for those sort of ideas, and all symbolising ideas of being intuitive and being in tune with reality. And so if someone just looking at internet sources, reading very negative books, or I know we greatly respect Alan Watts on cuttingthroughthematrix.com, and do look that up, it's a great website and great podcasts on there. But it's a dour view of reality, it's all based on documented stuff. I think reading between the lines, Alan Watts has got a little bit more hope than he says publicly. If you go through many of his things, there's a little thread here and there where he does have a little bit more of a belief in religion and even paranormal stuff that he would always make obvious in what he says. But his main message is a dour, slightly depressing one. You're powerless because the big boys, as he calls them, have done it all. The Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, they've got it stitched up. We've got the Olympics in 2012. It's all a new world order, and you might well feel hopeless if you see that as the only reality, you know. But if you understand you're experiencing that from an enlightened state, so you yourself are enlightened, but you're a beholder and a witness to these events. They're outside of yourself, they're not part of you. You're in this reality, maybe you're here to make it better in some small way, you know.
Sure.
There's no point in having a torch, you know, in a sunny environment. You have a torch in a dark room. You need to light a dark room. You'd light a candle in a cellar. You don't light it on a desert island in midday, you know. And if you're going to be enlightened, maybe you need to be going into these dark areas and bringing a bit of light to them. I'm not expecting it all to be lovely and wonderful. If we didn't have a problem, we wouldn't need enlightenment, you know. And it's not all going to suddenly happen in a sort of easy way. But go and walk in the hills, get more in tune with nature and stuff like that. At least that heals to some degree and brings you wisdom from experiencing things directly. Like I said, taking a metaphor of time and space, you know, if you travel for a landscape, it's a kind of a journey, it's like a pilgrim's progress. And we're all learning on the journey through the decades we're going through. And that's how you get wisdom. And a lot of what David likes talking about is that type of thing, really, because he's travelled to... South America, I know he's taken a bit of the ayahuasca and stuff, but you know, he's had a very green perspective in the past, and he's got a lot of what he says from his own experience, and he's got a great sense of humour. I mean, he had very bad attacks of arthritis after he was a goalkeeper, for example. He still suffers in a lot today from that. You know, so he's dealing with problems. He's not expecting everything to be perfect, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean? But he's very inspiring. He's very humorous as well, you know.
He is. And even people like Alex Jones, who I listen to, I mean, we both do, we occasionally will listen to Alex Jones's podcasts on Infowars.com and PrisonPlanet.tv. And he will say much the same. He'll say it's good to get out there into nature and to just escape from the city life and to kind of go back to traditional beliefs and traditional senses of morality. And you feel a warmth inside of you when you do these things, and you try to embrace what used to be seen as critical things for happiness.
Yeah.
And it's all about going back to our roots, really, as a species. But there seems to be this strange split now in society between what people need for sort of spiritual nourishment and what they're receiving in the mainstream media, and what the mainstream media try and promote is what's important. And my personal hope, if you like, for this year, for 2012, is to see a beginning, if you like, of some sort of spiritual collective improvement in our own sense of what's important, what isn't important. And what I look out for at the moment is signs of the mainstream media altering their outlook and the way they put things out, the way they represent things, and to sort of look and hope for a sort of more enlightened sort of world view, really. But it's all wishy-washy stuff, I know, but it kind of goes back slightly to a character that I've always been fascinated by, who was Terence McKenna.
Yeah.
Who died, sadly, died young, really. He was only 52. He passed away in 2000 of cancer. But Terence McKenna was a real pioneer of the psychedelic movement. And he had some very fascinating views on 2012. And he put forward this theory of time wave zero, which to this day hasn't really been analysed in any kind of great detail. Certainly not, it hasn't really received the attention it deserves, in my opinion, by mainstream academics. Mm. But McKenna never really believed it would, even though he did attempt to get it peer reviewed at the time.
And it is mentioned in Jeff Stray's book, which I had a look at the other night. There's a whole chapter about that in there.
Right. And for those that don't know, time wave zero is just an interesting mix of mathematical techniques and the ancient Chinese divination technique known as the I Ching. And Terence McKenna devised a way of essentially predicting world events via a mathematical formula that represents two distinct concepts. One is habit and the other is novelty. And when you look at the time wave zero, and for those that haven't, just all you need to do is Google it and you'll get some Java-based graph that takes you back 5,000 years and ends in December 2012. But the interesting thing is when Terence McKenna was out making this graph, he had no aim or no belief that 2012 was going to be some significant year. It just happened to be the point where time wave zero ended naturally. And it was pretty much on the exact day of the end of the Mayan calendar. Mm. So the idea being that this somehow was in sync with ancient predictions, which was very interesting. But what Terence McKenna demonstrated, arguably, is this idea that you have habit and you have novelty in world events. Mm. And you see, when you look at the graph, you see this change in the pattern when significant events have occurred in the past, such as 9/11. And World War II, and you can take it back hundreds of years even. But when you enter into this year, all of a sudden the rise in novelty is dramatic. And what you see is a peak in novelty at the end of the year.
So how do we define novelty though? And we're not talking little plastic toys and Christmas crackers, are we? We're talking, is it unusual events or different technological changes or
news? Yeah, well, this is the interesting thing, because McKenna never really defined it, because he didn't necessarily have a sort of definitive definition of it. But
yeah,
McKenna would say that it was a change in the status quo. It was points of inspiration, significant moments, significant events. Mm. It could be anything. And I mean, one of the interesting theories that he has, which I heard him talk about during various interviews and presentations he gave in the 90s, which obviously you can get hold of this stuff as audio files online, sort of rare MP3 files, etc. A lot of it's on YouTube, which is good.
Is it Psychedelic Salons and other?
Yeah, that's a very good resource.
It's podcast. Podcast channel.
Yeah, right? It is. It's been going for quite a few years now. But one of the theories Terence McKenna had was that he didn't sort of believe this necessarily, but it was just an idea he threw up into the air at the time. But he said perhaps the end of 2012 is the point where time travel is invented, and there's some secret lab somewhere where people are working effortlessly to form some device that allows them to travel back in time, and perhaps the end of 2012 is this point of extreme novelty where they managed to pull it off. And what his argument at the time was that if that did occur, it would break down cognitive barriers in the way humans think, because all of a sudden we may live in a reality where not only do you have a physical address, but you have an address that's placed within a timeline as well.
Oh.
So the idea being is that all of a sudden you're entering into almost a fourth dimensional reality. And the other theory is that if a time travel device is created, that exact moment is the point where thousands and thousands and thousands of people are going to want to enter into your time stream, because they may be, you know, 200-300 years ahead of you, and they all might want to go back to the point where they are able to reach the earliest stage of human affairs, if you like. But it's all very abstract, and it's all based on different views on time travel and how time travel is possible. But I think it's fair to say that it's a traditional view of time travel that you cannot go back further than the dates at which the first device was created that enabled time travel. So this is kind of what Terence McKenna is saying. So if that is in any way, shape or form feasible, sort of logical line to take, then it's interesting. It certainly seems like the kind of thing that McKenna would be looking out for if he was still alive today. But it's not quite the sort of thing that somebody like Icke would be looking out for. It's more a sort of event that can possibly represent a peak in novelty. And it's not just a peak, it's not just like a point at which we've never reached before. It's an absolute maximum point on the scale which it cannot go beyond. And then it ends, and that's the key thing. 2012 is the point at which time wave theory ends naturally.
And it doesn't resume later on, is it?
No, that's it. So if 2012 passes and there's no great event, time wave zero will unfortunately have been pretty much written off.
I mean, we did have an example of this, did seem to have some credence when you pointed it out to me in late 2010, and there was some sort of peak or something on there.
There was.
And we didn't know what was going to happen, and then it could well have been the Japanese earthquake and tsunami.
Yeah.
Seemed to be the thing that happened early in the next year in 2011.
Yeah, and then also we had, later in the year, we had the rioting, certainly a UK-specific event, that, but that seemed to represent something that was picked up across the world, some sort of sense of anarchy and frustration. Mm. And I think we saw various copycat riots in other countries. Well, we certainly did. And obviously the situation in Greece as well, where that was, well, compared to the London riots, it was full-scale rioting over there. But there's different theories on what represents a time wave point of novelty and what doesn't. But yeah, for my money, those things must have represented some kind of peak in novelty. Certainly, maybe not the rioting, because I think the thing about the rioting was it was frustration, and a lot of it was actual greed, in my opinion. In the UK, there's definitely a sense that we've got pretty much two or perhaps even three different camps forming now in this country, and you've got the alternative thinkers who want to see change. You've got the people that don't really think about it and just want the status quo, and then you've got this rebellious criminal element who perhaps were more active on those particular dates, but it's difficult to say for sure.
Yeah, I mean, like I was saying the other night, even if you look at the Occupy movement, it doesn't necessarily take on board paranormal or conspiratorial views anyway, and it's can be frustrating if it's looking at kind of old answers all the time and wanting to set up new political parties and this sort of thing, new organisations, which, you know, can have their place, but they're going to be the whole answer, you know. And I mean, going back to 2012 itself, I mean, obviously the Olympics is in England, or the UK as we call it, Team UK or GB, or sometimes I don't know where we live actually, they give it so many different names, you're not allowed to call it England, but no. It's a big thing. It hasn't really even got going yet. We've seen a few silly things on TV, but they're throwing unbelievable amounts of money at this, but they're also bringing in a hell of a lot of security and even military level stuff. Now you've got guided missiles and US Army coming, I think, or British Army and CIA or whatever they're importing.
Just Anglo-American establishment, basically.
I mean, if something did happen, you're being kind of not going to be surprised if it does. You know, this would be not long before 2012 on the 21st of December at 11:11 in the morning, which is the solstice that year, winter solstice. This would be a kind of bad thing to mess up everyone's head a little ahead of the time, and you should be getting into a good spirit to welcome in the winter solstice, I would say. You know, you've got because the Olympics is in August, and you've got September, October, November. You've got a little bit of time after that. But if society is going all up the spout around that time, it's going to be very distracting, you know. And the economy as well. You know, everyone's in a bad state to receive enlightenment. You know, you have to make a bit of peace in your own life to reflect on these things and get that state of mind, I think, because you know, you can't, it's like the reason why someone goes into a church is for the quiet, to reflect, you know, that's why these things were invented originally. And it's no good sort of just being lost in all the detail of what could be very traumatic events. I mean, if they stage some sort of terrorist attack, or Ian R. Kramer is talking about a fake alien invasion, which, you know, I'm sure is technically feasible, but
you might see Bluebeam,
a bit of a coincidence to happen right then. I'm not quite sure why aliens would suddenly want to target East London, you know.
No, strange.
I mean, that seems a bit weird after the velodrome or something. I'm not sure, but it could happen. All the media will be there to cover anything that happens.
That's it.
You know.
And I feel that we are faced now, perhaps, of a year of multiple challenges. As you've said there, Peter, we've got the economic situation, which can only get worse, unfortunately. I don't personally see it changing anytime soon. So people have a lot of challenges out there to deal with and to face on a personal level. But also you've got these slightly more global issues, and I do believe, based on the way things are unfolding, that we will see further conflict in the Middle East. And unfortunately, I think Israel and the US and perhaps the UK will eventually strike Iran.
So if we're looking at that, when would that happen in the year?
It's difficult to say. The problem with all this stuff is you always have these articles where some ex-Mossad researcher will say they're striking in October, they're striking in February. Mm. No one knows for sure. The only people that know are the military planners that are part of the gold team, if you like. The general consensus, though, is that they will strike this year, because if you believe any of the propaganda they're putting out about Iran's nuclear capabilities, if you wait any longer than a year, they will pretty much be ready to have a weaponized nuclear weapon. So if they are going to toe that line and use that as a PRS, problem reaction solution style tool, then they will have to hit them this year, because otherwise it will be too late. I mean, in the news the other day, we've already seen Iran test fire these radar evading missiles. There's talk of them actively pushing their nuclear program one step further. It's continuously, you know, pushing it, you know, increasing the tempo at which they do things at their end. Israel seems to be very close to launching some kind of strike. I frankly wouldn't like to put a date on it, but I would be surprised if it wasn't this year, for the simple reason that if they wait any longer, you're going to have a media reaction that's going to be based on this whole North Korea scenario, where they've already got the nuclear weapons, so you can't really do much about it. Because that's a theory that if North Korea didn't actually possess nuclear weapons, the West wouldn't have stood for them for as long as they have. No. It's a standoff that's essentially a stalemate, really. But that's just one theory. But my personal take on this is that it's kind of like going back to 2003 Iraq. They would use this as some kind of catalyst to justify more control, more surveillance, more power from the state. And also, it's just a very good chance for them to distract people from, if there is something in the air, and I'm talking spiritually here, if there is some great wind of change coming, this is the sort of thing that could tilt it in their favour, and talking in terms of New World Order. Mm. This is the kind of weapon that they use. As David Icke would say, it's a PRS scenario. Stepping stones approach, all these techniques that we know exist because they're so visible in the way that these worldwide events unfold.
Yeah.
And we may see a scenario where something like this kicks off and all of a sudden people are... the psyche out there changes, and you have people pro-war, people anti-war, but there's a sense of that we are, as a country and as a society, involved in a serious conflict. And this wouldn't be like anything like Iraq. This would be a serious war, and anyone that knows about military history and current military global issues knows that this wouldn't just be a cakewalk for the West. This would be a quite a serious conflict that could go on for years, and Iran would have a lot of surprises it could unleash on the world. It would affect the flow of oil. It would impact shipping in the region, so it imports and exports would be severely affected. It would impact the safety of Iraq and of Israel. And you have to remember that Iran has this force, Hezbollah, that they can unleash in Lebanon. So you'd see a new front opening up in Israel, such as, you know, a bit like what happens in 2006 with the Lebanon-Israeli war, which arguably Israel didn't win, but that's a matter of conjecture, really. But the scary thing from my perspective is that this would be a very big war. This wouldn't just be a walk in the park, and for that reason, it could actually have a significant impact on people's lives. It wouldn't just be the sort of war that we'd watch on the TV. It could actually be, and I mean, dare I say it, but it could even lead to a sort of draft-style scenario, particularly if a bigger country got involved, like Russia or China.
Yeah, definitely.
But we just don't know how it's going to unfold. And this is obviously worst-case scenario kind of stuff.
I mean, if it happens in the summer when the Olympics are on, you can have a very strange, schizophrenic kind of media. We are being asked to cheer on the Olympics while being asked to watch a war and cheer on the army, possibly, you know, or possibly not. You know, maybe everyone will be protesting at the Olympics, or God knows what, it could be a right mess. Different things being pulled in different directions, you know. And that, even if it happens not long after or before, certainly, you know, that would be equal. So it could be a very, very strange mix of things there, you know.
And as alongside that, if the economic situation gets worse, that's just another factor to take into account. Particularly if the euro folds up, which I don't... Speaking at the date that we're putting this out, it doesn't seem like a particularly far-off possibility, frankly.
No. Well, another thing we did, of course, a talk shortly after 7/7, which we have put out on the information, but it was actually recorded for a CD I released a few years ago, and it was about the London bombings. And we said then, because we were recording it in 2005, so we were looking ahead 7 years a little bit, and we said, I bet, you know, what would happen in 7 years' time. And we said, well, it will be the 7th anniversary of 7/7 in 2012. So that will be coming up. And that'll be a Saturday, I believe it is.
Right.
And then I've got London Pride on that day.
Right.
So what that says, I don't know. But whether they're going to sort of do anything then, I don't know. But it's interesting to see where these dates fall, you know, and project. I mean, we seem to have a long wait to the actual Olympics. We've got a gap in between where we're not sure what's going on. So whether there's any build-up to a war in that period. And the trouble with 2012 is so much is based around the winter solstice, which is very late in the year. So
In
some ways, this is the wrong, not so the wrong time of the year. We're in 2012, but, you know, we're right at the very start of it, you know, and it's, in terms of the things we've been talking about, they tend to have a more of an effect later on in the year, or the bias more towards later on in the year. And when you think of 2001 as a year, you know, nothing really happened in that year. We had a general election, that was it. There was nothing happening. There's, you know, usual political ups and downs. So then 9/11 happens right in September. Then you have an Afghanistan war in that autumn. Then you have the build up to the Iraq war through 2002, you know.
Yeah.
So things can happen much later on in the year, and suddenly the whole game changes, you know.
Yeah.
And it seems like the stage has been set, maybe, for things to happen later on in this year. But whether they do all happen then, or whether there's something before that. You know, last year we had the Japanese situation around March. So maybe something like that will happen, or maybe something with the economy before that, you know. And whether it's all controlled or not, I mean, Alan Watt or someone like that would say it's all controlled, all deliberate, but is it going according to plan? Have they messed it up a bit? Are they behind schedule? Are they getting desperate, as Alex Jones would say? Or, you know, is it a bit more random than that? And is there an awakening countering it? You know, the Occupy stuff, the stuff we're doing in our small way, other things like this. The listeners hearing this, they're all tuning in because they want to hear this stuff. They're all looking at other stuff as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, there's a flavour for it out there. And I also look, I look for, say, best way to describe it really, sort of otherworldly style events in the media as well, because I still have this sort of romantic idea in my head of 2012. I like to think of this big world-changing style event, and I'm still on the lookout for something like this. And one of the things that sort of interested me the other week was there's a lot of discoveries going on at the moment in space and in astronomical circles. And there's a new satellite now which has been launched by I think it's NASA. It may be the European Space Administration, but I think it's NASA. The Kepler satellite, a telescope even. And this telescope has already had some quite interesting findings. And one of the things that I mentioned to Peter the other day, which I'm keeping my eye on it certainly, is this discovery of a planet that's just been known, it's just been called Kepler-22b, I think, which is just one of many planets that have been discovered at this stage by this new telescope. But essentially this planet is orbiting in what's known as a habitable zone of a system. And it's interesting because there's been a lot of analysis on this planet. There's already a Wikipedia page up for the planet, and there's a lot of speculation now about the potential of life on this planet. Apparently it's 3 times the size of Earth, roughly. So if there was intelligent life on this planet, obviously the cultural significance would be vast, and that their culture could dwarf ours in terms of if there was suddenly some communication, we could suddenly find ourselves being overwhelmed by a sort of history and a culture that's alien to our own.
Well, maybe we should bring up here to listeners who've played the Andy Thomas episode about crop circles, which we put out recently. Andy summed up the crop circles of 2011, mainly in the southeast of England. And he was saying that they were kind of counting down almost, that there weren't so many this year, but is it a kind of countdown to 2012?
Right.
In fact, there are fewer crop circles, and maybe it's a way of them saying, well, we've kind of done that, we've told you where to look, sort of thing, and here it is now, this is it, go for it, And this could be like taking the stabilisers off the bike, what I mean?
Sure.
It's like saying, this is your moment now, ride, or something's going to happen, and it's not a rehearsal now,
Absolutely, and that's actually the wording that Terence McKenna used to use. He used to take, obviously, psychedelic substances and the infamous DMT trips he used to do, where essentially what he described as dribbling basketballs, used to speak to him at length about reality. And he said that one of the things they kind of implied was that this is sort of a window of opportunity for humanity. So this peak in novelty that we might see at the end of the year is a window of opportunity. Mm. And there's this theory that some of us might make it and then other people might not. So I don't know what that could mean in reality, though. A mass die-off of people that suddenly evolve to some new level of spirit of consciousness, and then the remains of the people stay on the planet and carry on watching the news. I just don't know.
Well, let's take that back a bit, Martin, because we don't want to get mixed up with the rapture, which is a thing that's probably a false idea, that you physically get taken out of your body and you go up into space, and this is the chosen ones, this is a religious idea. It's not in the Bible at all, it's not scripture. And it's been put out by those, I think, who are just trying to get cults to follow them, really. And it's a very literalised view. You physically go out of your car driving along and you disappear.
1950s sci-fi.
Yeah, it's great fun, but it's not going to happen that way, And it might be a metaphor for something. But what Jeff Stray does in his book, he does go through all the different traditions, and basically they do sort of coincide to a degree. And he says at the end, he thinks the general consensus could be that it's a pineal gland opening, going to high frequencies, so you could see more, you detect more high frequencies. That could involve the sort of alien contact that you've been talking about, or contact with time travelers or other entities. He doesn't know, because he's not trying to pin down an exact theory. He's going through all the different traditions and combing them like a beachcomber, trying to work out, what might be the truth, And he's got indications this is a general consensus, but it's not a definitive view. Anyone who says they've got the view is wrong, because it's not happened yet, and we'll be arguing 20 years after this what did happen, even if something does. I mean, they argue about JFK and stuff 40 or 50 years later. We're not going to know what happens on 2012 straight away.
No,
but I do think a bit of meditation, and that helps to kind of just be calm in yourself at least for a few minutes each day, to kind of be aware of spiritual type of things, which we can talk about another time maybe. And that helps, because then you would maybe feel what enlightenment is. I think it must be a living in the present, and knowing that it's maybe a holographic reality, if you want to look at it like that, or it's an experience we're having, but we're more than just what we're born as in a physical way. I mean, a character who spoke to us a while ago, Ian Bailey, was excellent. He was talking, really going for it, saying he was an alien incarnate.
Yeah.
And he'd been in civil war in America before, a couple of hundred years ago, and now he's here doing this job. And a very literal way of looking at it, a kind of reincarnation type way, you know, that might be part of it. But it could be that, you know, some of us do go to another dimension, it's just like this, but a better place where we're on another planet, or who knows. I don't think that'll happen in 2012, but I think we're here to have our experience in this earth. When we die, we may well feel though that that's opened a way of going to where we want to go. And 2012 may be a way of bringing this planet up into a higher realm, more like these other places. You know, there's been a lot of films made recently about, you know, different planets coming, like there's one called Melancholia, and there was of course the one you particularly liked,
Avatar.
No, the other one when we went to see, what was it called? Terrence Malick.
Tree of Life.
Yeah. We won't go into all the detail of that, but there is an outer space scene, and there's a meteorite coming to the Earth, so there's a doom scenario. In Melancholia, there's a planet coming towards our planet. I think there's another film, which I don't know the name of, but a similar idea. And there's talk of Nibiru in real life, this planet drifting into our solar system,
yeah.
Which, you know, I think we'd spot if it was there. But, you know, it might be dark, it might be behind the sun. I don't know. I mean, it could come a long way in 9 months, so keep your eyes open for that one. It could be a planet that's on the edge of the solar system. But the planet you're talking about, the one with the name...
Kepler,
that's many light years away. I mean, we can't communicate with it
directly.
No. Although the Large Hadron Collider is possibly now finding particles go faster than light, which is 186,000 miles a second, which takes a quarter of a second to get to the moon. If you think of that, scale it up, think how far it has to go to take 4 years to get to the nearest sun. But then if that's right, you know, we've been told that that is the speed of light, but... we've been told that it might not be true, you know. We're only basing a lot of these things on what we've been told. I mean, I've read a book called Dark Moon, Apollo and the Whistleblowers by Mary Bennett and David Percy, which talks about the fake moon landings and stuff. But it goes into more esoteric areas and says that it reckons there are 7 speeds of light which have been indicated in crop circles, and the speed of light in deep space is much, much faster, which would mean a lot of the stars are nearer than we think. Galaxies are smaller than we think. Space is smaller than we think. It's still huge, but it's not as big as they say. If it was really speed of light at, you know, 4 light years being the nearest star, it takes 4 years for the light to get there. This may not be the case. It may be that speed of light is faster beyond gravity. We only measure it in a solar system. Whereas gravity acting on us, we've never been further than the orbit of Earth. Allegedly to the moon, we won't go there into that one now, but even if we went to the moon, it's still quite near. We're still in the Earth's gravity, because the moon is captured by the Earth's gravity, and the sun's got gravity. If you get beyond the solar system, in deep space, there isn't the same gravity, so would the light change? Would the speed change? I can't say yes or no. I think Einstein had good ideas, but, you know, can't explain everything, you know.
No, and it reminds me of there's an interesting character who's known in UFO circles, certainly in abduction, people who are interested in abduction tales and alien encounter stories, a guy called Alex Collier, who's an American researcher who believes that he had contact with a race of aliens who are based on the moon. And this is all, you know, this enters into David Icke territory about Icke's recent take on the moon and the fact that the moon is actually at the centre of the conspiracy, and the reptilian race, for example, are actually based there, or maybe not based there, but perhaps they've got some sort of setup on the moon, some sort of operation centre. But the interesting thing about what Alex Collier said was that kind of relates back to what you're saying there, Peter, about the fact that our understanding of technology is only, it's kind of like a sort of initial level of understanding, and we're not perhaps secretly we are aware of all this stuff, perhaps in sort of secret government black ops projects, etc. But certainly the mainstream take of science, we're due to kind of evolve now, I think. Perhaps that another indication of what 2012 or the next few years might represent is a sort of culmination of different scientific breakthroughs that bring us to a greater understanding of the universe and of technology and of perhaps space travel. I mean, one of the things that I've always been fascinated by is this concept known as scalar technology, scalar energy weapons, which is, there's a whole debate on this subject, it's quite controversial, but essentially it's this view that one of the things that Tesla was able to achieve was essentially, for want of a better word, teleportation. So he was able to move an object through what is dubbed as hyperspace and basically allow it to relocate to a different location. So if this concept of hyperspace exists, which is essentially this vacuum, this sort of layer between two dimensions of reality, if something like that is discovered or is something that we can harness it in any kind of fundamental way, then suddenly the concept of space travel to these far and distant planets is feasible, because we're actually going through hyperspace as opposed to going in a physical direction and requiring speed and time. So again, it's something that would change the paradigm. It would represent a sort of paradigm shift in the way humanity thinks and the way we perceive ourselves in terms of locality and time. And this is the sort of thing that Terence McKenna would hopefully have been looking out for. And I'm sure that based on what he was saying in the 90s, he was certainly of the mindset that this is the kind of crux of 2012, according to Time Wave.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating stuff, and it's all... I personally, and obviously all this stuff, it's only personal perspectives, but I feel that we are seeing a build-up of events, and for that reason, the likelihood of something happening seems to be in place more than they were, say, a year ago or 2 years ago. And we are kind of reaching a point now where if the economy gets worse, we are in a sort of 1930s era depression. If war kicks off with Iran, we could see the catalyst of World War III. So sort of what I'm saying is everything's kind of reached a head almost now. So for that reason, I don't see a direction humanity can go unless we have some kind of big standoff style event, and whatever that represents, whether it be a sort of split down the middle or some kind of great war or some kind of great rebellion, some kind of overthrow of governments, who knows. And I'm basically, what I'm saying is I think all bets are off, but I just don't at this stage have enough of an indication of what's happening based on the media and based on alternative research, because people come at this subject from so many different angles. And I think one of the problems with alternative research is always that you're always fighting a battle between, you know, separating the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. So sometimes you feel as if you may be being led down the wrong path, and then other times you think you're back on the right track. And I think the key thing with all this research is to always remain impartial and to never narrow your focus on one particular subject or one particular view of 2012 or any subject that exists in this, you know, alternative realm of research.
Yeah.
But I think that's been a good analysis there, Peter. And certainly we will continue to study the news and study events as they unfold throughout the next few months leading up to the Olympics. And I think we'll probably have to do some kind of Olympics special nearer the time.
I'm sure we'll have things to say.
Yeah.
We won't be commentating the athletics.
No. No.
We'll be commentating what happens around it.
Absolutely.
I mean, if it's possible to go up there, I don't know whether anyone could go into the area. I think you can go into the area, but you can't go into the actual stadium. So it may well be we can go up there, and we're quite near the site. It's only 50 miles up the road. You know, it'd be quite possible to go up there, have a look around.
Yeah.
In the sort of main areas and you know, the outside of the stadium is like a big park you can go around, and I'm sure it'd be possible to get a flavour of things up there. A lot of it will be very banal and kind of your cheerleader types running around saying it's all brilliant, but we might get a bit of information up there. But you know, there's always a danger, like we said, of terrorist attacks and stuff.
Yeah.
If that's part of an agenda or a genuine thing that could happen. I mean, if Iran was struck, who knows? There may be some crazy guys who might have a genuine go at something like that, you know. But when they get ready all that time ahead with missile launches and stuff, you tend to think, well, they're kind of either planning something or expecting something, or they're just trying to scare us, you know. And it's a shame. It's like when 2001 came, you know, the year, we always like to think of the film about space and everything very inspiring, and then you remember it for George Bush and, you know, Twin Towers falling down, you know, and it puts a negativity onto something you were looking forward to for many years, you know. And so you've got to make 2012 your own 2012, whatever happens. You know, we all say Happy New Year, we might as well say it now, you know, a bit belatedly maybe, but there's bound to be good things amongst whatever does happen, and in a year's time we may be sitting here mulling it all over and raking over the coals, and we may still not really get an analysis on it. And it could be unfolding, like we said earlier, it's a gateway into things that are going to go on through 2013, 14.
Sure.
You know, it's you know, it's going to be, expect the unexpected, as they say, you know.
Indeed. So we're continuing to look, keep an eye out. And like with always, thank you for subscribing to the podcast. We're doing very well. We've almost hit the magical 1,000 mark for subscribers, which I don't think we ever really anticipated, but we're very pleased we've reached that point.
What we want is 2012 subscribers.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
For 2012.
Yeah, the aim for the end of the year.
Yeah.
So thank you and stay tuned for more.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.